if I remember all your book titles. So there's Simeon, and A Joyful Noise, and Adequate Earth, and The Garbage Wars, and Answer Back, and A Mote in Heaven's Eye, and is that right so far? And Don has a new book out, which is really a double book. There's a long poem called Endurance in this half. When you flip it over this way, you've got a long poem called Going Under. And Connie has a book out called Charades and Celebrations, and another really wonderful book called A Picnic in the Cemetery. And then she has a book which is finished now and will be coming out called The Lone Woman and Others. And Connie has also published a novel called Natural History. And together, the dynamic duo has written, under a pseudonym, a so far unpublished mystery called Fresh Air, H-E-I-R. So I'll turn it over to them. We're going to start with Don.
I was trying to figure out a way of organizing some poems around some sort of pattern, and it occurred to me that recently I had been writing some poems about the problems of what is known in the behavioral biz as interspecies communication, that is, communication between, in this case, humans and animals. And so I noticed that I had been writing about animals for years, and I decided I ought to read some of the older poems that I had written that related to that, and then build up speed to some of the more recent stuff that I've had really no experience reading to other people. So we'll find out how that comes out. I thought the first one I would read is a poem that would set the tone, called When I Was Young. I was a little worried about reading it because it really deals with the wrong season. I thought it was going to be spring, and then I would not have been able to read this poem. Since it isn't spring, I can read a poem about the fall, and you won't know the difference. This takes place in Vermont. I'm sitting in a bay window with my knees up and looking through them at the pasture. It's called When I Was Young, I Tried to Sing. Whoever I am, the mountains exalt themselves before my eyes, and if I do nothing about the mountains but look at them, they are all I am. What fills these trouser legs, what moves the pen across this page, is mountains. The colts tumble into the field on their implausible legs, wheel and wait for the mares, fainting at the timothy. So my eyes have gone running ahead. They stand peacefully drinking the grass. We are all, the colts, my eyes, these shoes, waiting for the mares. I catch a glimpse of the man who wears my shoes, before whom the trees line up with their backs to the mountain, and the mountain peacefully sets his hair aflame. I tune in on his pleasure. It is pleasure itself to hear his veins singing. I am moved easily these days. His pleasure keeps running ahead, my eyes nowhere. The colts are hiding behind his shoes. The timothy trembles in the windy shadow. No light, but the mountain's burning hair. We watch the trees assemble in the moon, the grass lift up her million silver tongues, and the mares drinking it in, drinking it in. I wrote a whole sequence of nasty poems to my dog, or at my dog, and then I felt a little sorry about it, and therefore I wrote some apologies to him. And this is one of them. It's called If He Could. I've tied my reason over my eyes. Dog trails at my heels through the weeds. Dog never asks why, only now? Never, where are we going? He drops his tail and follows his nose. If I could loosen with my miraculous forepaws the furious knot at the back of my head, I'd tear the reason from my eyes and send it flying. Now, now, dog would bark. Look where you're going. This is the garden. There is the wall. Now, he would howl. This is the beginning. Here is the tree. Give it a name. Earth finger. Moon beard. Sparrow mother. Here is the fruit. Call it good. The leaf. Green tongue. Sky feather. The sky. Star meadow, where the dead worm flies through the voice of the lark. If he could, dog would. And last, he would say, name me again. Hail fellow, fast companion, brother, give you good morning. And this one, though it's really dedicated to Binker, generally dedicated for every dog. For every dog, there comes a day. This is it. Henceforth, there will be no more collars, no more leashes, licenses, no more jangling tags, trappings of fealty. My name is Rex, King of Jackals. I belong to Sapiens, 123 Grovel Street. Henceforth, call me Snarl. I belong to my teeth. I live where I sit. You will set me a place at your table. Cut me a key of my own. Henceforth, I will go when I please, in or out. You will chain the cat out front to the bird bath. Throw him a bone, and when you call again, here, boy, look out for your throat. this is for cats. Actually, I feel more comfortable with cats, and that's why I had such a hard time working my way around to dogs. I think deep down I am a cat. This poem is called The One-Eyed Cat, who's become a kind of character. I think that probably there are more poems coming after this about him. Stalking the stony terraces, dressed in nothing but my lives, it's height I need. I'm only happy out on a limb. June wind licks white combers of boneset and Queen Anne's lace. The spruces shrug their dust-blue shawls and look away. A nestling dangles from my teeth. The grackles swoop and scream. Nothing can touch me but the wind. One old one might introduce the next batch of poems, which start with some attempts to talk to chimpanzees by using sign language and various other devious methods. I remembered that long, long ago, I'd become very interested in chimpanzees. Several things appealed to me in this particular poem. One of them was the fact that they seemed to be thinking whenever they scratched their head. They reminded me of Stan Laurel. One of the other things I had just discovered about them was that, unlike monkeys, which very often assemble themselves in very strict hierarchies and very large groups, chimps tended to hang around in small groups. They had very small alliances, twos and threes and fours. That made some sense to me. That's the only kind of organization I've ever been able to belong to, an organization of no more than about five people. This poem is just called Chimp. Stan Laurel. It's when he scratches his head, rueful, a little vague, but definitely a thinking animal. The same unmixed appeal, like children and the very old. Why is it so reassuring that man is not the first two-legged beast to discover he thinks and with what? Left to his own devices, he travels alone or in twos or threes. Not, like his more categorical brothers, in orders, complete with vows and hierarchies. Think how our early fathers, more often than not, were surly anchorites. No company would have them. Some barefaced son of a slightly dubious mother scratches his skull and finds the fly still walking upside down inside. The motels blink their neon yellow eyes. Fords growl in the underbrush. The jungle is safe again for democracy and the Legion. He looks at me from under his rueful wrinkle. I am less reassured. I want to whisper, I am not with the others. Essential man is alone, whether caged or free, whether nose to tail with his mate in the bog of desire, or trailed by a half dozen wet-nosed consequences. Through the hand-polished bars, he hears it the way it comes out. I am not your keeper. Quickly, let me read you a few of the poems then from the more recent assault on my attempt on what I guess is a struggle to communicate with the animals I somehow feel strongly related to. This first one is about a chimpanzee named Lana, who is kept in a little plastic cubicle with only one connection to the outside world, which is a computer bank. And if she presses the right keys, she gets whatever it is that she might need from a bank of dispensers on the wall. This is the only way that she can get anything at all. This is an attempt to prove that chimpanzees can speak language. Now, this language all comes out in printouts from the side of the machine, and it's all proven, all the sentences that she can say. And the quotations in this poem are either from Lana herself via the computer, or they are from her much less intelligent scientific cohort, Dwayne Rumbaugh. The first quote is from Dwayne Rumbaugh from a book called Language Learning by a Chimpanzee. The poem is called Please, Machine. To provide social contact, it was first decided that an orangutan, BG, would live in the language training situation with Lana. Since they had lived together for many months prior to the beginning of the study, they were close companions, and we hoped that they both might benefit from language training. Within the first few weeks of the study, it became apparent that the orangutan was a much slower subject than Lana. Where has she gone, sweet orange BG, silly, irresistible BG, dangling from the go bar, brushing the console with her toes while Lana fumbled the keys for their supper? Please, machine, give Lana juice. Please, machine, give milk, banana. Lana scowls at the keyboard. She knows why I call these plastic wafers keys. She wonders which one unlocks BG and where I have hidden the days of their ignorance in this plexiglass Eden, tickling, grooming, hugging, sharing, tussling under the Guggenheim tree. She was both interfering with Lana's work on the keyboard and restricting Lana's linguistic expressions to requests for the barest necessities. Please, machine, give Coke. Please, machine, give M&M. Sagely, the monitor blinks like an electronic angel. A relay clicks. Something hisses in the wall, and there is Coke. Dark, sweet, stinging her tongue with pleasure. Click, click, there is M&M, wafer of eternal bliss, body of the machine. Through the plexiglass, the banked dispensers glow as Lana taps out, please, machine, make movie, for 30 seconds of primate growth and development, which she knows by heart, her genesis in Technicolor, then back to the non-stop night and day commercial of the dispensers. Quite possibly the various incentives such as movies had held little reward value for Lana as long as she had the companionship of another ape. Please, machine, open window for a glimpse of the action east of Eden in the alleys of Nod where the technicians stray, white-robed and slim. Between the hunger and the monkey chow lies the machine. Between the boredom and the colored slides, the machine. Please, machine, tickle Lana. Clapped in her plastic cage, tapping out telegrams to the remote, elusive genius of the machine, her name and the machine's are one. All she needs is a lab coat and a PhD. Here's another one, another little character. Sarah was taught how to speak not through sign language, which I think is the best way to learn, and one I'm not going to refer to, but by putting little plastic counters, which were magnetized on the back, onto a metal blackboard, in effect, and writing sentences in that way, and getting what she needed that way, and answering questions that were phrased to her on that blackboard. Again, the problem seems to be that the investigators could never figure out why they were having trouble with the chimpanzees when they started to reach puberty. They were always kept totally alone and away from all other chimps. This one is called Of Course, and it not only includes the problems that investigators have had with chimps, but with other animals as well when they get horny. Of course. By the time of her fourth cycle, however, she twice attacked her previous favored trainer. The actual causes of the attacks are unknown, of course. When Sarah came into her fullness, she had been 7 years from home, laboring in the rational vineyard, having not once laid eyes in all that time on a male of her own persuasion, till Walnut, bright, obliging Walnut, came. She reached through the bars and, clutching him close, took his unfledged Peter in her mouth, scrotum and all, whereupon the trainer whipped out his clipboard and his flare. For a brief period, Walnut was used as a contingent event. On a board outside her cage, we wrote such things as, Sarah is good, if then Mary gives Sarah Walnut. And more explicit, Sarah insert cracker red dish, if then Mary gives Sarah Walnut. Instructions of this kind restored Sarah's work habits. For three inserted crackers in the proper dish, Mary give 30 seconds of contingent lust. Then the two screaming animals were torn apart and a highly excited Walnut was led from the room. There are, of course, alternatives. Take Lucy, who shacked up with a vacuum cleaner. When her labia bloomed like some carnivorous flower, she dropped her magazine and plugged him in, ran his gleaming nozzle over her body, switching from suck to blow. Until she had what I inferred to be an orgasm, she laughed, looked happy, and stopped suddenly. She then turned off the machine, picked up her unfinished glass of gin and her magazine. Or take the goose who married the garbage can. 3 furious years he defended his mate from the garbage men and danced the triumph dance under her battered, vacant gaze, mounted her in season, his wings, his heart aflutter. He would never react to greylag calls or even to females, but if you'd just rattle a piece of metal, he would immediately act as if there were another greylag calling him in the distance. When they carried her off for keeps, he watched them flatten her in the crusher, heard her death rattle, then followed the garbage hearse, of course, 2 blocks through the clangorous traffic till he was crushed himself. A couple of dolphin poems. Next week on Washington U campus is Whale Awareness Week. And this is a poem in which I take the responsibility for what some of us have been doing, any of us who have been eating tuna have been doing. It's called The Work of an Instant. And the her in the poem is a dolphin that gets caught in the tuna net. For an instant I glimpse her through the moonstruck tuna, milling and thrashing. She is composed now under the jostling, one flipper snared in the senseless mesh. The lunatic silver curtain closes. Beside me, my father, breathless, half spent, half the catch still to be stowed below, raises his bloody truncheon. His wet black hip boots gleam like a fearfully cloven tail. The wicked moonlight winks at the tip of my grappling hook as I plunge it into the frantic fabric. It's only the work of an instant to free her, and light years before I lose sight of her, sinking among gull scraps, wearing the old imperturbable smile, unresisting, goddess of garbage, the word made meat. And finally, my own commitment to communication with all animals. The quotation that starts this little poem is from Margaret Howe, who worked an experiment in John Lilly's book, The Mind of the Dolphin, in which she lived with a male dolphin for an extended period in a wet environment, in which she, in other words, lived in his environment. Her initial attempt was to teach Peter English, which always struck me as pretty silly. But this poem is called Shh. One time I let him ramble on and on, but I tried to copy all of his sounds. The tape was interesting. I was surprised at how well I was able to copy at least his pitch, and how he seemed to test me with new combinations of sounds. Listen. Alone among trees, I've come for a heart-to-heart with the woods. I fall on my knees for a tete-a-tete with a geode. Behind his limestone brow, I sense the clean, hard corners of his thought. Facet to facet, glinting dimly, postulates of amethyst and quartz. I'll parley with the loam, make peace with the Indian pipe. I'll learn to speak weedish.